Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest a poet whose work I like very much. His name is Charles North. His most recent book has the fabulous title, Everything and Other Poems. It's published by the Song Cave Press. And so he first came to my attention when I received in the mail a book called The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight. It was from a press called Adventures in Poetry. Its main editor was Larry Fagan. And as soon as I saw the title, I thought of the two songs it's based on, The Nearness of You and The Way You Look Tonight. The Nearness of You is a fabulous song by Hoagie Carmichael. The Way You Look Tonight, I'm sure some of you know it, was sung by Fred Astaire. It was written by Dorothy Fields and Jerome Kern. Two beautiful songs, but amazingly, the poem itself is derived from still another popular song. That was a song, it was called Younger Than Springtime. It was from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical called South Pacific, and I thought it would be best, before I ask Charles to read the poem, for you to hear, to be reminded of in some cases, or hear for the first time, the song Younger Than Springtime.
Younger than springtime are you, softer than starlight are you, warmer than winds of June are the gentle lips you gave me. Gayer than laughter are you, sweeter than music are you, angel and lover, heaven and earth are you.
That's William Tabbert singing from the cast album of South Pacific. The song is Younger Than Springtime. And what we're about to hear is a poem read by the poet Charles North, based on that song, but called The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight. Charles, there's a seed of how this poem came to be. Tell me.
Yes. Well, my guess is you agree it's a lovely melody, and I sort of grew up with it. My wife, Paula, likes it a lot, too. And although it's a lovely melody, and the show is very nice, we used to make jokes about some of the comparisons, because they were cliched, as putting it mildly, I guess. And Paula, I think, was the one who started it. So that there were comparisons that really weren't smarter than morons, shorter than giants, you know, which don't really mean very much, but in some sense parody, in some sense homage, I think, to the song, because I mean, I still like the song.
Yeah, I do too. In fact, I was made to sing it at a junior high school graduation. That's how popular these songs were once upon a time, the Rodgers and Hammerstein canon. And here is Charles North bringing new life in his poem, The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight.
The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight. Smarter than morons are you, shorter than giants. More reliable than bail jumpers, defter than those who are all thumbs. You are nicer than villains, stabler than those with bipolar illness. Readier than sousaphones or E-flat horns, more fragrant than monkey houses. Saintlier than mass murderers are you, peacefuller than janissaries. You are faster than tortoises, tighter than moo-moos, newer than hand-me-downs, cleaner than oil and grease stains. Hotter than meat lockers are you, more disinterested than investigative reporters. More heroic than cowards, healthier than chronic patients. For you are prompter than no-shows, more alive than someone pushing up daisies. Freer than convicts are you, stronger than weaklings. Svelter than nose tackles, more chivalrous than sentries. You are sprightlier than couch potatoes, more urban than dairy farmers, rounder than flatworms, apter than what is irrelevant. Finer than sackcloth are you, gentler than torturers. Firmer than invertebrates, kinglier than footmen. Fuller than vacuums are you, more staccato than slurred passages. You are more educable than dropouts, roomier than crawl spaces, humbler than show-offs, closer than the Big Bang. Wittier than blockheads are you, more legal than after-hour bars. Barer than furnished apartments, louder than quiet people.
The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight by Charles North, from a book of his that was published, 20 years ago, The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight. And one of the things I discovered when thinking about this poem in relationship to your new book, which is called Everything and Other Poems, it's published by Song Cave Press, is that in your work, you're toying with the idea that one metaphor is as interesting as the next. Put a metaphor in there and it's going to fit. There's nothing that doesn't belong. In fact, in the poem Everything, you see all thought and all images as inhabiting a huge thought bubble. I notice that this new book, Everything and Other Poems, follows a great big new and selected poems called What Is Like. Did this book begin a new direction for you?
That's a very good question. My feeling is yes, to some degree, not necessarily consciously, however. I really did have in mind doing a long poem. I had done poems that were 10 or 12 pages, and I thought I would try my best to see if I could do a really long one. I was aiming for 30 pages, and I think with the study that precedes it and the coda that follows it, it is about 30 pages. The title was, as I'm sure you know, partly a joke. It has an epigraph from Crazy Cat, from George Herman, which is, the epigraph is, "Everything is just nothing repeating itself." I kind of gave myself the license to go wherever the poem went, and that's what happened.
I've fallen in love with that poem. I must have read it in the last couple of days. It's a 30-page poem, approximately. I must have read it at least 30 times.
Whoa.
It must be a real challenge to keep a poem that has everything at its ostensible subject, to keep a poem going for 30 pages. What was that like?
Not so easy sometimes, easier at other times. But you asked about a new direction. Again, not quite a new direction, but I think perhaps a new freedom to let a poem unroll, see what emerged, and then decide what I would keep, what I would add to, what I would take out, and so on. So I think there was a certain, I don't think I could have done it 20 years ago.
You know, I was reading the book of essays that you put together called States of the Art, and gradually across the book, you speak of your poetry, in particular, as growing less formally designed, and the word you frequently use is sloppier, by which I don't think you mean sloppier. You're just having a good time. You mean freer, yes?
Yes. Will you forgive me for correcting you?
Mm-hmm.
I think the word I used was messier.
Messier, sorry. I'm sloppy. You're messy.
Yeah, I'm sure you know what I mean. It's, you know, letting more things in, not being as careful as I used to be, or formal, actually, because I've fooled around with a lot of forms in my time.
Like many poets who live on your coast, East Coast poets, New York poets, you started writing poetry in one of Kenneth Koch's workshops. And I want to know, because so many poets, Ron Padgett, so many people, Sherry Fine, people I've known for years and years, began writing poetry in Kenneth's workshops, not to mention the hundreds of public school children and people in old age homes who were taught by Kenneth about poetry. What was it about him that made him such a good teacher?
He was a tremendous enthusiast and champion of poetry. And he loved more than anything else. He loved it when you wrote a poem that he liked and even envied. His championing of poetry was absolutely genuine. He's also exceptionally well-read. And in my case, since I had had a kind of conventional education, and I didn't start poetry until really pretty late, my middle 20s, he introduced me to all kinds of poets who became my favorites, but whom I was barely aware of, if at all, when I was getting my MA in English, for example. I was pretty conventional. I didn't know much beyond English and American poetry, I confess. And again, he was very much concerned to introduce people to the poets he loved, whether they were his friends like Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery, or Lorca or Rimbaud.
I'm talking to Charles North. He's the author of the new book, Everything and Other Poems. It's published by Songcave Press. We're talking about his beginnings. As so many New York poets, he began in class at the New School in a workshop with Kenneth Koch. And when I read his books about writing poetry, there seems to be no one more generous or hilarious than Koch is about his love for poetry. What did the class feel like?
You know, I've been teaching for years, and I've been teaching poetry writing for quite a long time.
Yes, at Pace.
Yeah. And I think pretty much what I do came out of the way Kenneth did things, rather than the famous Iowa model, which had more to do with students workshopping and going over one another's work. With Kenneth, it was more reading to us things he loved and thought would inspire us to write and that we would be able to use as models. And also reading back to us things that we had written and submitted that he thought were effective and would excite other people, and giving us assignments, some of them very strange, some of them not so strange, but all of them, I hate this expression, but I'll use it, certainly for that time, out of the box. It wasn't the sort of thing I was at all used to. Again, I had a pretty conventional education. I had tried a number of different things until I discovered poetry. And then as I've written elsewhere, it changed my life. He changed my life. I mean, he really did.
You're so lucky. I remember, for instance, one of the extraordinary things he mentioned somewhere was that he asked his class to write a five-act play with 150 characters in 2 pages.
Yeah, things like that.
Yeah, insisting that you invent and that you take creativity to the hilt. And I feel in your newest book, you're doing something fascinating to me. Your writing, pardon me for guessing at this, simultaneously a hilarious and theoretically serious poem in everything about the nature of poetry in its ability to speak about everything. Everything belongs, and everything can be worded into its own original formulation, so that as I was reading, I was sitting on edge to see what you would do next.
Yeah, I hope that's true. I like very much what you said. I don't think I'm in a position to say that my poem was hilarious. I think that's for you and for readers to say. But I like very much what you said. And the notion of everything really was in the back of my mind all along. It was the title of the poem, and I had planned it for the title of the book, if it ever came, right from the start. So yes, I was trying to do all sorts of things. And by the way, when I teach, one of the things I try very hard to do is to peel away the received idea that all poetry is serious or somber, or that you can't have a mix of tones in a poem. And I think I was just doing it maybe to a larger degree in this poem than I've ever done before. I suspect, I hope, that I've done it in the past as well, but maybe not at such length.
I want to know, Charles North, can you think of a way of saying what happened to poetry? Because although there are places in the country that still teach metrics and rhyme, they're darn few, very few. And what was once upon a time the structure, the foundations on which poetry was based, they've basically gone away. How did that happen?
I think it was happening for a long time.
Yes.
Gradually. You know.
From Whitman on, at the very least, not to mention Emily Dickinson.
Absolutely. And I think it was helped a lot by the European poets in particular, whom some American poets got to know and love and imitate in the mid part of the 20th century. And I think it was also helped along a lot by the several groups of poets who were brought together in Don Allen's anthology, The New American Poetry, and who prior to that had really pretty much been underground. I never met Frank O'Hara, much to my disappointment. So anyway, I think that once this book came out and these poets, California poets, Black Mountain, New York poets, beat poets, and so on, you know, with kind of loose categories because there was overlapping, I think that it can be overstated, but I think it did an awful lot to help along the change in American poetry, which had been noticed, but really only among certain groups of poets prior to then. Is that your feeling? I'm curious.
I think that everywhere I look, whether it's abroad to Ezra Pound, even T.S. Eliot, they all know the formal basics. But for instance, in Pound's case, he's sick of them.
Yeah.
And he wants to make the tweeting sounds that the troubadour poets were able to make that didn't exist in English and American verse at all. He wanted the poetry practically to chirp. And of course, since Ezra Pound was chirping, could Marianne Moore do anything but follow? She wanted to chirp too.
Yeah.
William Carlos Williams enjoyed, because, you know, Williams hated T.S. Eliot and hated the European formal, didactic, difficult methods of poetry. He wanted to write a poetry that he could write between appointments. He was a doctor. He'd write poems on his prescription pads, and he'd write them as fast as could be written. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm on KCRW. I'm talking with the marvelous poet Charles North about his new book, Everything and Other Poems. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Charles North about his new book, Everything and Other Poems, which is published by the Song Cave Press. And it is a book that proves North to be a poet who can teach us what it's like to think about everything. That poetry famously can go anywhere, and he provides us with poems that do. These are distinctly post-John Ashbery poems, but I think what's fascinating to me is that many of the poems, am I right, take place in an implicit classroom. People, listeners, are asked to raise their hands to comment. There are discussions within the poems, and the poems find amusement in the idea that for the most part, people who read poetry are taught to read poetry. Yes?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I have to agree, at least in part. I don't know whether any of that was conscious either. I know people do come in and talk in the poems and say things, and I hope it works.
Many of these poems seem to shrug off explication until they ask the reader to provide a sample. What do you think? Where would you go from here? I think it's a very interesting way of proceeding.
I think that's extremely perceptive of you, and I'm not sure I could have said that about myself.
Those of us who read are doing something different than those of you who write. And when we tell you, you're interviewing us as much as we're interviewing you. You've had the pleasure of writing these poems and seeing what people say about them. I'm sure you're frequently surprised, yeah?
Of course.
What happens to you when you hear someone who wants to ask questions about meaning? Poems, I've been led to assume, no longer are about meanings. That's not what poems do. Poems delight you with their verbal facilities, complexities, surprises, pleasures. But meaning isn't a pleasure. Meaning is something that my grandparents knew about.
Yes. That's very interesting. I teach an honors class at Pace, which I made up a few years ago, entitled The Pleasures of Poetry. And it's precisely to try to disabuse people of the notions about poetry that too many of them learned and have trouble forgetting in school, especially in high school, most of which have to do with meaning. The poem is a puzzle and deep meanings and hidden meanings and things like that. I do tell them that there are occasions when it's helpful to spend a little more time than one would normally wondering what something means as a route to grasping the poem and getting the pleasure that's really there. But I also try to make the point that that doesn't happen very often, and that the meanings in general can the whole subject, poem as puzzle and hidden meanings and so on, can be set aside really without any penalty, that most of what's interesting and pleasurable is there, right there.
You mentioned that the writer, Raymond Roussel, who spent a good deal of time with his mother, constructed a coffin for her that had a skylight, so while she was above ground, he would be able to look at her. I think that poets are capable of ingenuities of every kind. Whereas other people find ingenuity difficult, ingenuity in poetry is frequently simple. You, in your poems in this new book, you point out that the E's at the end of words that are not sounded, like the E at the end of suicide, must be very unhappy to be there. without being pronounced. And you have a good deal of fun making lists of words with silent E's in them. This isn't the kind of poetry that causes you to furrow your brow. I think the point is to unfurrow the brow, yeah?
Yes. Again, my hope is that whatever pleasures are there are not merely are superficial or fleeting, you know, going by very fast.
I want to tell my listeners that a wonderful thing to do now is to go to your computer and look up Small Press Distribution, the new book, Everything and Other Poems from Song Cave, is available there. So are many of the other poems by Charles North, but so are the books of poems that you should be reading if you want to give poetry the opportunity to surprise and excite you. The books you'll want to read are not being assigned to you for the most part in most schools, are not coming out, are not found on the shelves of many bookstores. Small Press Distribution, if you look at their list, they describe each of their books. Why not try out books by poets you haven't read before? And order while you are Everything and Other Poems by my guest, Charles North. I've been speaking with Charles, author of Everything and Other Poems, published by Song Cave. Thank you, Charles, for joining me.
Thanks very much, Michael.
It's been a real pleasure to me. I have to tell you, I've been wanting to talk to you for the 20 years since I first read The Nearness of the Way You Look Tonight. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, all the other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to our co-producer, Sean Sullivan, our wonderful associate producer, Alan Howard, and technical director, Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Ariana Rhines is our guest.
She's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.